Hi, everybody. My name is Tom Scott, co-founder, chairman of the Nantucket Project. As usual, I'm with R. Pietti, CEO, founder of Ergo. And today we're joined by Dr. Nicholas Christakis, who I've known of for quite a time. And he and I have never met until today virtually. But he former, a hospice physician who runs the Human Nature Lab and is a professor at Yale. He's also author most recently of Blueprint, which is now sitting in my Audible file on my iPhone. I listen often more than read, and I'm very, very much into this book, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society, which is, by the way, out on paperback now. And I love this. Humans are hardwired to value goodness. And we're actually making three films on the topic of love right now. And one of them is The Science of Love, which I don't even know what that means, but I'm in the process of learning what that means. And it's a film I'm excited to be making. So anyway, but thank you for being here. We appreciate you taking the time.
No, thank you so much. I mean, actually, the capacity for love is itself an evolved capacity that we have. It's a key part of our species, this ability that we have. There are analogies in other species as well. This sentimental attachment to people that we have sex with is very distinctive in our species, but it's also present in other species that mate for life, for example. Except we experience that in a richer way, we think, as love.
So in the spirit of love, we're a little bit of an oddball organization. Oddball only in the sense that there aren't that many of them. I don't think we're actually have the characteristics of strangeness per se, but having said that, what's critical to us is what we call the head and the heart. Nothing original about this, but the notion is that matters of the heart and matters of the head are importantly linked. And I don't want to be part of the noise of a political or elite conversation. I mean, we stray into that world, and I accept that. But in the end, we believe that a heart without some logic is sometimes useless, and you know, a heavy emphasis on the head without the heart can lead to an evil or a misuse of great efficiencies, perhaps, or great opportunities, let's say. And in that spirit, we run what we call the Neighborhood Project, and we did a project in New Orleans recently that, just as a mood setter, we thought we'd kick off today's show with this as we lead into the conversation. So I am going to let that play.
Can the human connection survive isolation? I believe it can.
The need for the Neighborhood Project is as strong as ever, maybe stronger than ever.
This is the first thing that's bringing us all together in a whole different way.
You know, it's so hard for all of us to actually push pause in our lives. What good can come of this?
Are we at a point right now where we get a chance to rethink what it means to be neighbors?
We get together and share stories, and people bring out the best of themselves, and they care for each other, and they help each other, and they inform each other.
Just watching the clip and just seeing you makes me teary.
People are gathering in the places that need it the most.
It's an experience that's happening simultaneously, and where one community can turn outward to another for help.
I'm just happy to see all these Louisiana folks on the screen.
We are in a city that's known to come back, you know, and I'm sure that we'll come back again. My son, he's just coming out of isolation because he did test positive.
Just got over the message over the phone. Another person we know from the Lambeth House just died.
My neighbor across the street passed on Tuesday from the virus.
Well, and we all know that Ellis Marcellus died. A family like that unites the whole city, and so we all feel that loss. You know, we won't be able to celebrate.
Right, he can't have his jazz funeral.
That's right. We think about their family and the distance that there is right now. That hurts, you know.
With the passing of my father-in-law, you know, I realized that, you know, we didn't get down there enough. We didn't get to spend enough time with him, and that's a special relationship that you'll never get back. And we might have taken it for granted, which breaks my heart. So.
I had congestive heart failure a week and a half ago and ended up in the COVID positive ward, the lockdown ward at Baptist Hospital. And I watched medical caregivers with cheer and with overt faith and with gentle hands. The first nurse, she said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "I'm frightened." And she said, "Don't worry." She said, "I will protect you." And I just burst into tears. I've never been the same.
I will tonight be praying for each and every one of you, you know, and a special prayer to my brother with the mother in the Lambert house.
We can't hold hands. We can't reach out the way we did after Katrina, but we can reach out with grace, and we can reach out with dignity, and we can reach out with love, and we can reach out through the screens, and we can connect in the ways that we're allowed to connect right now. We're being brought to our knees. We know the only way we're going to get off of our knees and back on our feet is if we each grab the people on either side of us and stand.
So yeah, we'll stay in touch. And if you guys are open to doing it again, we hope that
absolutely
connecting was helpful.
It was lovely, and everyone should stay safe and healthy.
These things are as necessary as they've ever been. They're more necessary than they've ever been.
We just did another one on Saturday with corrections officers. It was profound. Dan, who's part of the tech crew here, was part of that as well. But the point I wanted to make is that, and you know, the conversation that we're going to have here, you know, relates in many ways to the world that we're in, but I think it's just important to set the context to a certain extent of what is that world that we're in, and ultimately these stories, which, you know, we're in this new world where we usually do these live, but we're doing these virtually now because of the nature of what's happening. Ultimately, it's that story that we just showed, and stories like those that sort of sits behind our concern and our focus and all the different things that we're applying right now. So I thought we would start it off there. Anyway. So thank you all. And by the way, Nicholas, if you have any questions or comments on that, I'm happy to stray into that. But
I'm now finding myself curious what the project's all about, although I made some assumptions and inferences based on the clip that I just saw. And you know, the line, that very powerful vignette from the older man with congestive heart failure, where the nurse says, "I will protect you." That's an incredible statement and an incredible story. And reminds me of a line that I was taught as a hospice doctor, which is when breaking bad news to patients as a doctor, a very crucial thing to say to patients, you know, you can say for them, for example, you can say to them, you know, you have a disease and I can't stop your disease. I'm powerless to stop your disease. You could say, and you're going to die from this illness. But what you should also say is, but I will not abandon you. And that commitment to non-abandonment, which is such a fundamental commitment in hospice care, is a line and a philosophy I was taught and something I said countless times to countless patients. But the line, "I will protect you," is an even more dramatic statement. So I was very moved by that story.
Do you, when you think about your own work, because you and I were talking earlier about like new, and you like to discover. I like to discover. I mean, I discover in, frankly, ways that are probably a lot less important than the ways you discover, if I'm honest with myself. But, you know, there's some part of that that is...
There's a creativity. There's so many ways to be creative in the world. You know, science is a creative act. Art is a creative act. Jazz music, we just heard about. You think the Marsalises aren't discovering stuff, aren't creative? Yeah. Filmmaking is a creative act. It's all, you know, there's so many ways to see new things in the world. And it's almost a childlike quality if you think about it. And so that experience is not unique to scientists by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, well, when I think about, I was just saying, discovery is interesting.
Well, and I think it's, you know, when I think about, so RP, you know, back in the early 90s was part of the group that put together a plan and a system to deal with pandemics, right? Way back then. And, you know, one of the things that I think a lot about is, what is it about my own curiosity, and what is that new thing that drives me? Now, I mentioned that I'm 13 years sober. There's a part of new that is addictive, right? I don't want that. Is that just my own boredom or my own disposition of anxiety that I want to get out of by discovery? Well, I think there's some of that. I think there is some of that. But I think there's something else, which is, this is my theory, is that I think within us, there's an evolutionary desire to discover the necessary. The necessary, and that whatever that means, right? And that's when I think about, why RP were you so passionate in 1992 about a pandemic plan, or, you know, what drove you to deal, you know, as to think of yourself as someone who cares for others in a medical way? I don't know. I think there's something that relates very closely to that spirit of discovery that may drive you. Again, I'm theorizing in a way that is more art than science, but it's how I've always thought about it.
I think isn't there this moment of absolute euphoria when you discover something / solve a riddle, right? When you come up with something new and, to your eyes, interesting, if not brilliant, that's an unbelievably euphoric moment. And I think for many of us, and I don't know, and Nicholas, you can tell us if it's genetic or if it's a learned trait. For many of us, there's also this sense of euphoria from service. And when those things come together, like when you discover a thing that helps other people, woof, that's amazing. Now, the footnote is, there's not much left to discover, right? So the book, Cassandra, that was, you know, thousands of years old, the idea, but building a pandemic response plan, 96, by the way, for the government, it just hadn't been done, right? But those two things together, like service and discovery, that's a couple euphorias together.
Would you say that you were called into service, Nicholas, in the last month or so? And that, because I know I want to talk about some of the new things that you're doing, but
I wouldn't say I would call, for me, calling is a very specific meaning. And I would describe medicine as a calling. Of course, people who are religious, you know, ministers will say they have a calling. And I certainly, as a doctor, I felt like that was a very special time in my life. Why I chose medicine, the years I devoted to being a practicing clinician, the fact that I chose hospice care, all of those things might have certain special qualities that, if we were talking about that, I might use the term that was a calling. But the scientific work I've been doing recently with respect to coronavirus, I would just say it's more of an exigency than a calling. I mean, what happened in particular was I had been vaguely following the events in China in January, but wasn't paying a ton of attention. I mean, I was aware that the epidemic was brewing. And I run a lab at Yale University, and we have a lot of projects, and there's a lot going on, and we do everything from public health to social robotics to the microbiome to big data, network analytics. I mean, basically we study human interactions in all of those various forms. So how the microbiome might spread from person to person, how autonomous agents online might reshape our interactions for the better or the worse, how technology might affect human social networks, the evolutionary biology of networks, and why we have friends at all, and the physiology of friendship. So all of these projects, although they're very different fields and methods, are all united by this interest in human social connection, and I've been doing that for a long time. Anyway, we had a whole bunch of stuff going on in the lab, and I had these Chinese colleagues with whom I've worked for a while using phone data in China. And And we had been looking at, for example, what happens when an earthquake strikes. How does that shock and disturb social interactions? Or what happens when you build a high-speed rail line? How does the introduction of a high-speed rail line between two cities modify the social interactions, for example, of the people? And we've been using phone data to do that. So I had this established scientific collaboration with these scientists, and they contacted me January the 24th, and they said, do you think we could do a project on coronavirus? And that, and we began to work on that project in earnest on the 24th, and submitted that paper on the 18th of February. And that paper is under embargo right now, but will be out soon, and we can discuss that separately. But anyway, because of that collaboration, I began to pay much more attention to what was happening in China. And I also have a bunch of Chinese graduate students, and they were telling me what was happening. And so I was aware immediately on the 25th when the Chinese government promulgated regulations that are called closed off management that basically restricted 930 million people to their homes beginning January the 25th in what I had called a social nuclear weapon, that the Chinese had detonated a social nuclear weapon to stop this adversary, the virus. And so I began to take it extremely seriously. By the end of January, it had all my attention. And certainly by the first week in February. And I began to redirect my lab to begin to think about this. And so we started taking on projects one after the other, and we can talk about some of those if you want. One of them is an app that we're about to release called Hunala, H-U-N-A-L-A, which is built on some ideas that we invented for the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. So, and then other projects as well, which we can talk about if you want. So more and more of my laboratory was being now redirected to study coronavirus. And then by the end of February, I had gotten very disgusted with the political leadership in our country and what many people were saying, which was plainly false. RP, I'm sure, was also hearing these things. And as anyone who had a modicum of expertise with epidemic disease, you were hearing these statements. And as I was then also aware of what was happening in China, and this was before the Italian collapse, when I think people then started to pay more attention in the West, I decided in early March that I needed to do something, and I had this small Twitter following, and I decided that I was going to try to set out basic information about epidemics and pandemics. And to my amazement, there was a lot of desire for apolitical, like plain spoken scientific information about the virus. And tens of millions of people were like reading these tweets that I was sending out. And so I started trying to do some sort of public, you know, advance the public understanding of science work as well. Anyway, the upshot of all this is that it's been all coronavirus all the time for me since January, January the 24th or 25th. And here we are now on April the 21st. And so what is that? That's 2 months that all I have been thinking about and doing almost exclusively is coronavirus.
You know, RP, I saw you nodding when you were talking, Nicholas, about your tweeting and apolitical. What's at the heart of that? Like, what is at the heart of that interest and why the nodding? Because you were reacting to something there, RP, that I find interesting, and I just want to dig into that just a little bit.
I think it sounds like Nicholas and I went through a similar set of emotions. I don't want to read too much into it, but one, like, holy Moses, what is my government not doing and why? And what, this is absurd. And then the next emotion probably is, I guess I could scream and yell and use Twitter for what Twitter seems to be good at, which is a place to raise everyone's blood pressure, or maybe I can help people understand what's going on here. And that's, Tom, I think that's the reason I think there's value in what you and I are doing is I think we're helping. Ideally, the recrimination will come later. There will be like a Corona Commission, as we said, like a 9/11 Commission. But for now, let's just make sure we can share facts and data and help people make the best decisions they can. And they're not, you know, and we're trying to work on that. So I think it gets to the point we're making earlier about, you know, there's an unbelievable euphoria in having a really neat solution. And if that solution helps people, And in this instance, there's nothing to discover. There's just like, here's some facts that we got to talk about and make sure we understand what the realities are. And let's do that. And if that's how we can be part of this, then great. You know, and I said it before in one of our conversations, but you know, that whole patent speech, what'd you do in the great WW2? I wasn't shoveling shit in Louisiana, right? This is the moment, this is World War III. And to be part of anything related to making this better, that's what we have to do. And it's a selfish thing. In this instance, service is selfish, and that's okay, right?
I want to hear about your, go ahead.
RP, I would agree with you. I think that there's not a lot of to be gained as a nation by, in real time, engaging in recriminations. However,
yeah, there's a big however.
Yeah, the big however is that a lot of people are continuing, despite the manifest
yes
danger that we are in, and the essential requirement that we take it, that we approach the problem initially, at least from a scientific point of view, and then we can have our political disputes about how to deal with these facts. Like, here's the set of facts, and then we might have different beliefs about what policies to implement in response to those facts. I'm still seeing a lot of politicians plainly either being irresponsibly incurious. Like, for example, the governor of Georgia, like yes. a week or two ago, said that he had just learned that there was yes. asymptomatic transmission of the disease. For God's sakes, the CDC is in his state. I mean, what kind of a person is responsible in that type of a role and doesn't pick up the phone and get a briefing, and then from experts, and then he can say, look, you know, I know there's asymptomatic carriage. However, for these other reasons, we're going to do the following thing. So this, the problem, however, for me, is that there are still people who don't want these inconvenient truths. And incidentally, I'm working on a book about this. The this tendency to try to deny reality actually has been present for all plagues, going back hundreds of years. There are always people who want to pretend that there's not a problem. In fact, let's not forget that in China, it began with the Chinese authorities in December calling Dr. Wenliang Li, an ophthalmologist there who was trying to sound the alarm, and having him, you know, saying, deny the plain truth, accuse him of rumor mongering, you know, this authoritarian government, and have him deny the reality, which he retracted his statements, you know. But they're just like Galileo being forced by the Catholic cardinals to say that, you know, the sun moves around the earth. That doesn't make it so. So denying, you know, asymptomatic carriage, for example, of the virus, or claiming that things are true when there's no evidence for them, is irresponsible. And so this is the problem. I agree with you that we don't have the time right now for recriminations, but we still have people who aren't willing to say, yes, these are the facts. However, for example, you could say, there is no evidence that the hydrochloroquine is helpful, no robust evidence. However, for these other reasons, I'm going to support it. But you can't say, oh, there many people are saying that there's evidence, you know, I mean, which is not enough factual basis. So anyway, that's my problem.
There's the biased and the ignorant, right? Right. And there, you know, you understand cognitive bias better than anybody. There's massive cognitive bias, massive denial and self-denial, all sorts of things going on, complexity, mismatch, satisficing, all these errors of thought happening on one side that are largely innocent but stupid, right? So those are biased and ignorant, innocent but stupid. And then there's like the malintended, and I'm not using the EVIL word, there's like the malintended group. And you each group requires a different response. Now, yeah. The malintended group, unfortunately, is doing a really good job of being the schoolyard bully. So when you attack them, they attack back, and all of a sudden the dialogue's lost, right? They yeah. dig in, this becomes partisan, this is, you know, your fake news. Holy Moses, that isn't working. So because we want a positive outcome with the malintended, meaning the people who intentionally know what's going on, and I don't think they're intentionally lying. I think in this instance, it sounds like they disagree with you and I. They're like, look, capital at all costs. Capital must win. The market must win. We're very willing to say, as Dr. Oz was quoted as saying, he apologized later, but unfortunately he's the one we'll remember, 2-3% death is okay, right? However, whatever his quote was, that group, which is philosophically different than where I am at least, you know, has to be confronted. But we have to be very careful about how we engage in that conversation, because they do a really good job right now in this hyperpartisan environment of just saying, oh, throw you away. Look, that's more evidence of the conspiracy thereof, right? Whereas the biased and ignorant group, you know, need to be educated. But the thing they most need to be educated on is their bias. And that's a fact, as you know, many studies, you probably wrote one of them, but that I remember reading and it kind of brought a tear to my eye in a sad way. Like, the one of the great lessons of bias is, even when people are exposed to their bias, they can't overcome their bias. So, like, we're in a, this, the complexity mismatch challenge is a real one, right? Like, the mismatch between how complex the situation is and the decision maker's capacity to understand it, plus the denials, plus, and I'll add one last thought. Unfortunately, what's coming out of this is we're now seeing ad hominem attacks of science and scientists, right? And I've seen smart people say, oh, the epidemiologists, this is their moment in the sun, so they're trying to grandstand. Like, I don't think so. I think they're just trying to share their data so that you as a decision maker can make a multivariate point of view. You can look at the economy, you can look at the science, but you need the data on some of it. Sorry, a little bit grandstand.
Yeah, I mean, no, that I agree with everything you said. I was going to just say that famous saying, you can't reason a man out of a position he hasn't been reasoned into. And you know,
that's good.
But I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. I think trying to disarticulate what is it, what disagreements do we have that are based on a disagreement about the facts? You know, for example, how yes. fatal is this condition?
Yes.
So let's go out and find out. So here's all the evidence. Here's how we know. Here's how we don't know. Here are the assumptions you have to make. And here's our best estimate with the range of, you know, probabilities. Then, given that estimate, now we have to say, okay, what are we going to do about that? And the latter question, I can see there might be disagreements. You might think we should do this. I think we should do that. But the first step, I really think that we should be able, what, you know, regardless of ideological commitments, at least agree to that. And this is why I'm finding it so frustrating that some of these basic ideas are being politicized. And it doesn't help us right now. You know, it really doesn't help us.
We're far behind.
To say that, oh, the epidemiologists, you know, want their moment and stuff. I know countless epidemiologists. Believe me, they're the most sun-averse people that you can possibly imagine. You know, they just want to be in their labs, you know, counting numbers and looking at bacterial plates. I mean, it's not, they're not that way.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying for a long time, like, part of the complexity mismatch issue and some of the reality is the biology and the treatment news facts are coming later than would have been more powerful if they come earlier. But to be able to sit down and have a real understanding of what the outcomes are based on different scenarios would be very powerful. But, you know, you, I'm sure you well know there's, for example, a variety of epidemiological models right now. The one the White House is using from IHME from the University of Washington happens to be a very optimistic model. And there's a lot of criticism of that model. There's criticism of everyone's model. But you also, unfortunately, at this point, can cherry pick your science. So this is a dangerous time.
Yes, that's right. Yes, well, and that's the nature of science, too. Not everyone agrees, right? People are constantly trying to argue about,
well, and then,
you know.
So I'll tell Tom one last point. Another challenge that we talk about in the book to get to quick solutions is what we call scientific reticence. So FDA phase 1, 2, 3 trials are great, tried and true. We love them. Well, is this an exigency where maybe we have to accelerate some of that? Do we reduce some of the scientific reticence and move ahead? Or will we end up with a President Ford swine flu vaccine problem from the 70s? Like, it's, you know, there's a lot that has to change. The frameworks have to change here to do this right.
Yes, I agree with that too. And incidentally, and that's partly why there's a lot of disagreement amongst some of the scientists right now about certain parameters. Although the scientists can articulate why, I can say you think this and I think that, and here's the reason I think you're wrong, and you can say here's the reason I think you're wrong, Nicholas. And so we can have a certain kind of conversation about it, you know, guided by a certain set of principles. The same thing I think is going to happen, but people are scrambling to measure these basic parameters about the pathogen. And they have been since January. I mean, the Chinese scientists were publishing a ton of stuff, which I've been reading now for quite a long time. Then the Italian scientists, now we're publishing stuff. It's, you know, it's an overwhelming fire hose of information.
And some of the key numbers keep moving, like the CFR, you know, keeps changing.
Yeah, but we know the reasons that CFR is moving. And so we can understand why initially in an epidemic, and this is historically true, the case fatality rate typically starts out looking pretty bad and then typically declines and does that for certain reasons I'm sure you know and we can discuss. And then also over time, the pathogens in general evolve to be less deadly because from the germ's point of view, it doesn't want to kill us, right? It would rather that we walk around and infect other people. And this is why the first SARS epidemic in 2003 burned out. It was too deadly. It killed us too fast. It's like Ebola. So generally, as time goes by, the pathogens, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that people know and have known, and we could talk about it like in a scientific way. But I just want to pick up the thread you said about what happens when you're facing an emergency. And here I agree too, is that, you know, we don't have the luxury of taking the time, and we are going to have to make decisions based on imperfect information and even disagreements. And this, unfortunately, is also going to affect our development of vaccines, because it's, although I'm increasingly confident we will have a vaccine in 18 months or whatever, I'm also very worried and increasingly certain that this vaccine will not be as safe as other vaccines, and the public needs to be prepared. Our political leaders cannot tell us, oh, we're going to cut some corners, we're a great America, don't worry, we're going to have a vaccine. I think we should be prepared now, say, look, you know, usually vaccines have a 1 in a million complication rate. This vaccine is going to have a 1 in 10,000 complication rate, but as a nation, we're going to tolerate that. And let me just say one more thing. I think part of the problem here is that there's been a lot of talk. Mark Andreessen just had an interesting essay that sort of picks up on some of these themes. Jonathan Haidt has been talking about this for quite a while. Politicians, military experts, scientists, educators, people have been talking for quite a while about, you know, people talking about grit and Angela Duckworth. I mean, there's just a lot of different people that from a lot of different perspectives have basically been saying the following thing about the United States, which is that we basically, I mean, I'm going to say we've gone soft. That's not what I mean. What I mean is there's a kind of sense in which we think that we're entitled to have our cake and eat it too, and that sacrifice will not be required. This is false. We're in the middle of a plague. People are going to die. The economy is taking a hit. There is no panacea. There's no easy out.
Right.
Everyone is going to have to sacrifice. It's going to be bad. People are going to have to run risks. Students, if you want to go back to college in the fall, you can't go back. It's not like it was a year ago. You're either going to have to do something different, if you're a college student, for example, have the unpleasant Zoom instruction, or you're going to have to be willing to take a risk of your life to go to school in a time of plague. And that's just the students who have it easy because they're not so at risk of dying. Everyone else is going to have to take a risk. Everyone else is going to have to struggle. We're going to have to live differently for the next few years.
Well, those students take a risk of infecting or killing their parents or grandparents.
Yes, or their professors, which they may not find as problematic. But the point is, we are being attacked as if by aliens. You know, there's an outside pressure that is impinging on our society, and there is no as easy escape. There's not like, oh, we're going to the Congress is going to spend trillions of dollars. We're going to borrow from the future and spend it now. It's not that kind of an attack. It's a different kind of an attack. There's no escaping this virus. It's going to have its way with us. This virus is going to become endemic. There is no other out. Either we get a vaccine or we get herd immunity. There is no other escape. And so the sooner we realize this, and the sooner we acknowledge that we're unfortunately, not forever, thank God, but for the next 2 or 3 years, going to have to live differently, the better for our society. And this is one of the problems I'm having with politicians as well, is that they somehow want to tell the American public, oh, you know, we're going to open up again. We flatten the curve. This is totally ridiculous BS. Yes, we did flatten the curve, but all we did is stop the spread of the pathogen. We did not eradicate it. It's there. It's going to come back. So anyway, I'm sorry I'm getting very emotional, but it's just, you know, I want us to face the reality, the unfortunate reality that we are facing. And that is that, you know, something unusual has happened. It happens once every 50 or 100 years. And that is that a new pathogen has been introduced into our species. And we have to fight that pathogen, not each other.
You know, I'm going to bring up, I'm reading a lot about testing. If there's a place of optimism I have, it's in the realm of testing. And a lot, as I was listening to you guys speak, and you guys know this world so much better than I do, and I accept that. I as RP knows, I continue to be encouraged.
Although you have the much cooler background, Tom. Like, you obviously can do things I cannot do, judging from what's behind you compared to what's behind me. But go on.
Well, I'm just this is as good a hobby as perhaps that is. So I think of it as that. But I'm blown away by the level of intensity of interest in solving this problem. I am encouraged by the ingenuity of our culture and our system, generally speaking. And I wonder, and by the way, amen to what you described as we're gonna take a hit on this. We're already taking a hit, we're gonna continue to take a hit. I do have a certain blind-ish faith in the fact that we're going to innovate ourselves into the best way to handle this possible. And that among the solutions, and this is something I just got today, this comes from Citigroup, Andrew Baum, who's a MD, global head of healthcare research. And he talks about a test that will be available in the United States to about 90 million people in July. That's what that says. Now, as I read that, again, I don't come at it from a scientific point of view. I think, okay, man, if I had a test, or the people I work with had a test, or the organizations that I work with are going to have a test, I could imagine, just in my own simple head, ways around where I could manage myself around a point of safety. And I'm going to bring this image up, and you guys can tell me your thought on this image. I saw this image, and I thought, okay, I can do something with this image. Can you see that?
Yeah.
This is how I'm thinking now. I start thinking about how am I going to navigate my life in that 18 months? And if I'm thinking that way, I have to believe a lot of other people are thinking that way. And might it be that within this sits some degree of normalcy? Now what they say in this city study, which is interesting, is that the way things stand now, we're looking at a 7% hit to GDP. But if with these kinds of solutions, he projects that perhaps it's a 2% hit to GDP. Anyway, I just said a lot of things, and most of them were relatively theoretical, but I'm curious how you would respond to that.
We've never seen, obviously, scientific cooperation like we have now. I just saw something that there's almost 1,000 different trials going on for all sorts of treatments related to this. It's amazing, lots of cooperation. There are still some silly problems with IP and other issues. But Tom, just to understand, what you just said and what Nicholas just said are actually the same thing if you look at a calendar, right? So Citibank says they'll be testing in July. That's a number of months away. The White House and others are saying we should open up too sweet. And so what that means is we're going to open up while the pathogen is still in the environment, and we don't have the capacity to test everybody to see where the challenges are, and we'll have a double bump. So those are both realities. And we are eventually going to solve this, which wouldn't have been the case, by the way, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. There's, for example, one entire vaccine technology that's relatively new, the mRNA vaccine technology, Nicholas, that ideally won't be one that would put it to too much risk and could be faster. That's a relatively new technology. So the opportunities available for humans to solve this are awesome, but there's going to be a lot of time and a lot of damage before we get there. So both realities are the same, but every month matters right now when we have the reality of this economy in front of us, which is, you know, going to be a huge hit. And the punchline of that is the poor and disenfranchised people in this country are like in humongous trouble.
Yeah, I
think Nicholas, tell us if you, whatever you're about to say, if you could have it dovetail with your app, I'd love to hear about it. If it doesn't work at all, it's fine.
Well, no, I mean, I'm mindful of the time as well. And I'd like to mention, yeah. I mean, we are picking up on what RP said, first of all, people tire of lockdowns, first point. And so there's only so much time before you get disobedience. Second, there's limited evidence. I don't think we're going to get, typically with these respiratory pathogens, when the summer months come, the heat comes, you get a bit of a relief. The evidence so far is against that. By and large, the evidence about that is against that for this particular pathogen for various reasons. So I think we'll get a mild benefit from the summer, not much. I think, you know, we're going to have stood up our supply lines and our hospital systems. I think people are going to get a little bit more accustomed to what's happening. Mask wearing is going to improve. Physical distancing. I think we're going to get people are going to emerge from lockdown, you know, within a month or two. But we are going to get a second wave, because there always is a second and a third wave of these new respiratory pandemics, almost for sure, in the fall. And so both for the emergence from the lockdowns and because of the second wave that's likely to occur in the fall, we've released a tool that's based on some ideas from work we did with the H1N1 pandemic. The gist of it it's like ways for coronavirus. It's like everyone contributes a little information about what's happening to them and around them. And then all of us benefit. You can then watch what's happening in the social network around you. It's all anonymized. It's privacy respecting, kind of like Waze is. You don't know who contributed the information about the accident or, you know, the police location, you know, with a speed trap or whatever. But you contribute information and you can benefit from this collective contribution. And what it does is we use some machine learning techniques, some ideas we invented in the lab 10 years ago, and modern app technology so that you, once a day, you are asked if you've had a fever or any contact with the healthcare system. This app is called Hunala, H-U-N-A-L-A. And if you haven't had a fever or symptoms and you haven't seen a doctor, you're done. That takes 2 seconds. If you have, you go down a little branching thing and you might answer up to a minute of questions. When you first sign up for the app, you also tell us a little bit about your social interactions, who you know, and those people are also invited to participate in the app. You know, they're pinged and they said, oh, a friend of yours signed up for this app, would you like to sign up for it? At the moment you answer your daily survey, and you don't have to answer a daily survey, but if you do, it makes everything better. Your location is detected, but only then. The app doesn't otherwise track you. And then the app links to online sources of information about what's happening to coronavirus and respiratory disease in your region. And we're building some other tools as well using these machine learning algorithms. And then after you give us your information, then you're given some feedback. You're told, based on where you live, here's the risk of coronavirus or respiratory disease in your area. And it's a little bit like those fire, you know, risk of fires. You know, if you've ever gone to a national park, it says, you know, today is a hot and dry day, and there's a high risk of fire or low risk of fire. So you get a risk based on where you live. And in addition, based on where you are in the social network, how many friends you have. And today you're not infected, but your friends, people you don't even know, they had respiratory disease 2 weeks ago or 2.5 weeks ago or whatever we discern is relevant. And that pathogen you see is now winding its way towards you. These are the ideas that we explored and published years ago. And so that information can be given to you as a form of individualized risk based on where you are in the network. So your first risk is your global risk based on where you live. And then you have a subsidiary refined risk based on how many friends you have, how many of them happen to have symptoms, and how many of their friends happen to have symptoms, and so on. All of that is processed and then fed back to you in an anonymous way. So we think this app will be very useful to people as they emerge from lockdowns. It's not just pro bono publico. You're also doing a public service when you complete this information. You can allow policymakers in an aggregated way they can know. For example, just like the police department might know if it had access to Waze data, you know, where are accidents occurring? You know, this is a spot where repeatedly people indicate there's an accident. And so now we can track, this is an unsafe part of the highway. So the highway department could then aggregate information and know what's happening. So just like that, public health departments can know where are hotspots, and our app can also forecast where the hotspots will be. And the way it does that is the following. If you think about a contagion that begins in a social graph and that's winding its way across what are known as the geodesics, across the path of ties through the graph, people in the middle of the graph, popular people basically, but it's a bit more complicated than that, popular people are like canaries in a coal mine. They're going to get the epidemic earlier in the course of the epidemic than the average person. Incidentally, that's related to the idea that we've seen all these politicians and celebrities get the epidemic, the pathogen early. It's not just that they have access to tests or access to the capacity to announce, oh, I have coronavirus. It's also that they are at higher risk. They're shaking more hands. The average politician is in contact with lots of people, and they are like a canary in a coal mine. But what we're doing now is we're putting this power in the hands of people themselves so that in a decentralized way, like Waze, they can share information that's happening to them and what's happening to them that can be aggregated and then fed back to them and give them insight, vision into what's happening in their networks, in their extended networks. Anyway, we published all this science 10 years ago for H1N1. We've now put it into an app and built a machine learning algorithm for it and are hopefully going to release it any day now, certainly we hope by the end of April, on the Apple and Google Play stores.
I mean, my view would be yes. What I would wonder is, I'm among the kinds of people who don't like my information out there. Generally speaking, I'm all for my information to be out there right now. And I would guess I'm relatively of the norm. That would be my guess. I can't prove that, but I think that would make sense.
And yet, I mean, just want to ask you, Tom, when you want to navigate somewhere, I'm sure you use Google Maps or something like
for
that.
Sure. So for sure.
You're
and by the way, I yeah, and
you have
I
confidence
value
that
those
that information
people on
is
Waze.
Say that again.
I love when those people tell me there's a crash coming.
Yeah.
And I feel like I want to participate too.
Yes,
when
you,
you
feel
say
like
Google
I'm not
Maps.
Just gonna, yeah, I'm not
Google
just gonna
Maps.
Be a user. I'm gonna mark, you know, there's like a sure. flat tire, there's you know, whatever. I'm gonna help the collective, yeah.
Well, Google Maps is a perfect example of I will only use Google Maps. Why? Because I know the data sets are outrageous. I want good data. I want to know exactly when the traffic's going to slow down, when it's going to speed up. I mean, Google Maps has taken me in from downtown Manhattan into Brooklyn to get home. I mean, I live in Connecticut. Like, that's ridiculous. Well, it was true, and it's because of that powerful data. In this case, I'm all in. And especially, by the way, especially if you can test me, and if you can test 90 million Americans, I think a lot of Americans would take the test, enter their information and say, here I am, this is what I got on the test, you know, this is what the test told me. Isn't it the case that with a pretty universal adoption of what we just described, wouldn't that be super powerful?
Yeah, we could, we do have a feature where people can say, have you tested for COVID? We do not, have not implemented a contact tracing thing, although we could in principle. So we could implement a feature where you share that with your friends or people you've
right.
been in connection with. We are not doing, our app is not like the stuff that's been done in Singapore or in Israel or and does not take advantage of the new Google Apple Bluetooth API for a variety of reasons. But we're offering something different. We're offering the capacity for individuals to forecast what's going to happen in their area, to know that 2 miles down the road, there's a traffic accident. And so that's something completely different than anyone else is doing. And of course, the more people that adopt the app, the better and better it becomes, the more accurate and precise it becomes. We had originally planned to just launch it at Yale University. We started working on this technology in March, frankly, in early March. There's a kind of an interesting origin story. I ran into my nephew, who's a computer science student at Yale, actually a senior, and he had done a little toy thing, which was a merger of Instagram and the experience sampling method. It was a little thing called Unexpected, a little toy app where once a day you were pinged and then you had to take a sort of a casual photograph of yourself and share it with your friends. You know, you had specific friends. And so it's experience sampling method plus like an Instagram. And I'd taken him out for dinner in early March when I was like all coronavirus all the time. And he told me about this thing. And I realized that work that we had published for the 2009 H1N1 epidemic, actually in the modern era of app technology, could be reinstantiated in this way. So we started working on this project. And then I got some professional programmers in my lab involved. And then we build and build and build, and it became a whole thing. just like you could share, you know, your latest meal on Instagram, you could share your COVID status with your friends. And this would be useful to them in certain ways. Certainly aggregated, it would be useful. But that's not at the moment an explicit function. We're just trying to give people the power to forecast that, you know, 2 miles or 5 miles down the highway, there's a major traffic accident. You can veer off and avoid that hotspot, basically. And so our app, and the more people that use it, the more powerful it will be and the more effective it will be. But right, oh, I remember what I was going to tell you. So we had built this thing, and our original plan had been to just launch it at Yale for Yale students. And we had buy-in from the administration, so we were going to have very high penetration of students. We thought it was going to go viral very quickly at Yale. And the plan was to launch it in the middle of March, right during the spring break. And when by the time the students came back, you know, there would be big adoption. And then we were going to expand, you know, in a kind of collegiate way. But of course, the colleges were all canceled. And so we were obliged now to have a metropolitan scale launch where we will basically go national right away. And, you know, we're concerned about that. Not so much because of, I mean, I don't, if we're so lucky as to have hundreds of thousands of users, we built it to be scalable. But it would have been better for our machine learning algorithms if we had been able to collect data first for these 5,000 people, then for this 10,000 people, then for these 100,000. Whereas now we're just going to have this enormous spread out all over the country numbers of people. So it's going to be a bit harder for us. But we think we're up to the challenge, so that if we're so lucky that people find value in this app and use it, then we know it will work. And we can scale with it.
You have to go to class.
I do, in just a few minutes. I have to go teach, actually, yes. Anyway, I'm really glad to finally participate in the Nantucket Project.
I'm glad as well.
Nicholas, I'm excited to read your book.
Thank you, RP, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to both of you. Nice I'll be in touch you. With all of you guys.
Take care. Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.